Today, we are going to look at one of the most mysterious people in all of Bible history. A man who had always appeared as an anomaly in the biblical record, an inexplicable character. That is, until the letter of Hebrews was written. And the person that I'm talking about is Melchizedek. We have actually ran into his name several times already as we've moved through the first six chapters of Hebrews. And even in these references to him so far, it's been kind of mysterious. And I've told you, you'll have to wait till we get to chapter 7 to find out who this person is and his significance for us. We're picking up the subject that the author dropped way back in Hebrews chapter 5, verse 10, which was the comparison of the priesthood of Jesus Christ and Melchizedek contrasted with the Levitical priesthood of the law that God gave to the Jewish people through Moses. Now, if you have been following along with us over the past several weeks, you might remember that the author interrupted his discussion about the priesthood of Jesus at Hebrews chapter 5, verse 10, to address what he believed to be a serious problem with some of the people that he was writing to. They weren't taking or making the kind of progress that they should in their knowledge and understanding of Jesus Christ. They were dull of hearing, he told them in verse 11 of chapter 5, meaning they were sluggish. They were lazy about the relationship with Christ. Many of them had been Christians long enough, he told them, that they ought to be able to teach others by now. But instead, they need to be instructed again and again in the most basic elements of their Christian faith, the ABCs of Christianity. They're still drinking milk from a bottle when they ought to be able to eat and be eating solid food, he told them. And so he gave them a warning that they needed to get with it. This lackadaisical attitude that they have about their relationship with Jesus Christ and growing in their knowledge and understanding of him is not a good course for them to be on, nor is it a good course for us to be on. So he writes in Hebrews chapter 6, verse 1 and 2, he said, "Therefore, let us leave the elementary doctrine of Christ and go on to maturity, not laying again a foundation of repentance from dead works and of faith toward God, and of instruction about washings, the laying on of hands, the resurrection of the dead, and eternal judgment." And we are going to do just that today as we enter into chapter 7 of Hebrews, because this is what he's been trying to get them prepared to get into, is chapter 7. I would venture to guess that some of the stuff that we will be speaking about today and in the next two or three, 4 weeks coming, that it's going to be brand new stuff for some of you. It's the kind of stuff that's not talked about in church sermons very often, for fear that people will not put up with it, since it demands some thinking on our part. If you have been attending Touchstone for very long, you know that I have a much higher opinion of you than that. We do stuff here sometimes that requires a little bit of thinking. And so we'll do some more of that today even. We're here to learn and not just be entertained and be made to feel good about ourselves. Sometimes, rather than watching the Disney Channel, we need to turn over to the History Channel. And so today we're flipping over to the History and Theology Channel. So let's get to it. In order for us to appreciate the comparison between Jesus and Melchizedek and the contrast with the Levitical priests, which the author is going to make in this chapter, he spends the first 10 verses of chapter 7 reviewing the history of Melchizedek and pointing out the superiority of Melchizedek to the Levitical priesthood. the priesthood of the Old Covenant. He helps his readers, which includes us, to develop an understanding of Melchizedek and his significance. And this is what we're going to do today. We're going to only go through the first 10 verses of chapter 7. Don't want to hurt you too bad today. It would be fantastic if we could do the whole chapter, because the first 10 verses just kind of get us ready for the rest of the chapter. So you're going to have to remember everything that we said today for next week. So I hope you're taking notes. You may remember that we did the same thing in chapter 1 when Jesus Christ was compared to angels. We needed to have an understanding of the grand majesty of the angels before we could really appreciate the comparison that he makes between Jesus and angels. We did the same thing again in chapter 3 when Jesus Christ was compared to Moses. We needed to have an understanding of Moses, what he accomplished, what a remarkable person of God that he truly was. And once we came to that point, then we were able to appreciate and understand the comparison of Jesus and Moses. And here again, we have the same approach being used with another comparison. In the previous comparisons, we had to do some of our own work to build an understanding of the thing being compared to Jesus. This time, the author does most of that work for us. Well, why? In the case of angels and Moses, the readers of that day already had a pretty good understanding of these things. So the author relied on the understanding that he knew the people already had about angels and Moses. See, they didn't have the same corny, false mythology about angels that's common in our own day, where we think they're these cute, chubby, childlike creatures. And since many of these people were converts from the Jewish religion to Christianity, they were very well acquainted with Moses. We, on the other hand, are not Jewish Christians of the first century, so we needed to do some homework, some background work to help us understand what the author was really driving at when he compares Jesus with angels and Jesus with Moses. Well, in the present comparison between Jesus and Melchizedek, not even the people of the first century had a good understanding of Melchizedek to draw upon. See, Melchizedek has always been a mystery and a puzzlement, even to the Jews. So the author takes the time to make sure that we all understand the significance of the mysterious details that surround this character of the Old Testament before proceeding with the rest of his argument. And that's what we're going to do. So turn to Hebrews chapter 7, verse 1, and we'll get into this. Verse 1, it says, "For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. And to him Abraham apportioned a tenth part of everything." Melchizedek is only mentioned twice in the entire Old Testament. Psalm 110, verse 4, which the author has already quoted a couple of times in Hebrews, chapter 5, verse 6, and then chapter 5, verse 10, where he says, "You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek." This quotation from the Psalms doesn't give us a whole lot of information about Melchizedek, though, does it? But believe it or not, there's more there than we might think, as we'll discover as we get into this chapter. The only other place Melchizedek is mentioned is in Genesis chapter 14, verses 18 through 20. Here's the story of Genesis 14. The story is told about five kings of the Jordan Plain area who had been defeated and then subjected to the king of Elam for 12 years. These five kings then decided that they had had enough, so they joined forces and rebelled against the king of Elam. Well, in response, the king of Elam, along with his three allies, marched down to teach these rebels a lesson and bring them back into submission. So the battle lines were drawn, the five kings against the four kings. The king of Elam and his three allies, they routed the five kings, and the conquering armies ransacked the cities of the five kings, carrying off everything of value. One of the defeated city-states was Sodom, which was where Abraham's nephew Lot was living at the time. So Lot and his family were captured and carried off with the plunder and many of the other people to become slaves. Well, when Abraham heard what had happened, he quickly assembles his own Delta Force squadron, and he goes after them. Amazingly, he caught up to them and he launched a surprise attack, defeated the captors, recovered Lot and the other people and all of the plunder. Then on Abraham's way back home from the battle, he's met by Melchizedek, king of Salem. Genesis 14, verse 18, "And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed him and said, 'Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High who has delivered your enemies into your hand.' And Abraham gave him a tenth of everything." That's it. Those are the only places Melchizedek is mentioned in the Old Testament. And all of the information that we have about this mysterious character is right there before you. But there's more there than meets the eye. Because continuing in verse 2 of Hebrews 7, it says, "He is first by translation of his name, King of Righteousness, and then he is also King of Salem," that is, King of Peace. So the first thing that the author draws our attention to about Melchizedek is his name. He is first, by translation of his name, King of Righteousness. We've talked before about the significance of names in the ancient world. A person's name was much more than just a label. The name defined a person's character and personality. So Melchizedek, whose name means King of Righteousness, was a King of Righteousness. Righteousness characterized him and his kingdom. To be righteous means to be in a condition that is acceptable to God. He was right before God. He did what was right in the eyes of God. He was acceptable to God. It reminds us of Hebrews chapter 1, verses 8 through 9, when the author quotes Psalm 45:6, applying it to Jesus Christ, and he said, "Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of uprightness," or righteousness, "is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness." As we go through these, if you're paying attention, you'll catch many parallels between Melchizedek and Jesus Christ. And there is our first indeed. Well, the next thing the author points out to us is Melchizedek's title. He is also King of Salem, that is, King of Peace. Salem comes from the same root as the Hebrew word for peace, shalom. Melchizedek's title was literally King of Peace. It reminds us of the familiar title that Jesus Christ himself has in Isaiah 9:6 when he's called the Prince of Peace. So taken together, Melchizedek is King of Righteousness and King of Peace. These two themes, righteousness and peace, play an important role in the salvation of the human race, don't they? Because the righteousness of Jesus Christ has brought us peace with God. Now, Salem is also another name for Jerusalem. This adds additional interest to the comparison, because Melchizedek was King of Salem, or King of Jerusalem, which would become the city of David, the capital of Israel, the location of the temple, the center of worship, the place where the sacrifices were offered, the place where Jesus Christ will be crucified, ground zero for the salvation of the human race. Melchizedek is the king of Salem. Verse 3, he is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. So next, the author points out Melchizedek's family tree. He is without father or mother or genealogy. In other words, no one knows who his father or mother were. No one knows anything about his ancestry or his relatives or where he comes from. Melchizedek, just like Jesus, was a priest from a different tribe than that of Levi. The only people who were allowed to be priests under the Old Covenant had to be from the tribe of Levi and then from the clan of Aaron, his direct descendants. But Jesus, just like Melchizedek, they're not related in that way. They are not part of that genealogy. They're from a different order than Levi, based on genealogy. And then the next thing the author highlights about Melchizedek here has to do with his lifespan. It says, having neither beginning of days nor end of life. In other words, no one knows anything about his birth or his death. Some have taken this to mean that Melchizedek never did die. Well, the text doesn't really say that. All that it can be said about is the actual Old Testament reference is that it says nothing at all about the birth or the death of Melchizedek, and it leaves it a mystery. Finally, it says, resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. Melchizedek is similar to or resembles the Son of God in regards to these various characteristics. It's important to note that it says Melchizedek is like the Son of God, not that the Son of God is like Melchizedek. The Son is the original that sets and establishes the pattern that Melchizedek resembles. There are certain truths about Jesus Christ, the Son of God, that the record of Melchizedek draws out. But these truths find their full and complete fulfillment and expression only in the Son, Jesus Christ. So Melchizedek is a reflection of the real deal. Well, verse 4, the author continues and he says, see how great this man was to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the spoils. Referring to the story that we looked at in Genesis 14. Abraham himself was a very great man. The Jews considered him the father of their people. Of all of the people on the earth, God chose Abraham and gave him the promises that we talked about last week in chapter 6, verses 13 and 15. The Lord promised to make Abraham into a great nation of people and to bless the whole world through him. In other words, to bring the Messiah through his lineage. Remember? It was this same man, Abraham, from whom Melchizedek received a tenth of the plunder that had been recovered from the four kings in Genesis 14. In the ancient world, it was not uncommon for you to give a portion of the plunder to your god or to an important spiritual religious figure as an expression of thanksgiving for your victory. Implicit within this offering was an acknowledgement of your subjection to the one that you paid tithe to. And so Abraham giving a tenth of the plunder to Melchizedek was an open acknowledgement by Abraham that Melchizedek is his superior. This serves to highlight how great this man Melchizedek was. And so he says, consider how great this man was, that Abraham paid a tenth to him. Verse 5, he says, and those descendants of Levi who receive the priestly office have a commandment in the law to take tithes from the people, that is, from their brothers, though these also are descended from Abraham. But this man who does not have his descent from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. So the author explains the significance of Abraham paying the tithe to Melchizedek, by comparing how the tithe works under the law of Moses. Under the law of Moses, the descendants of Levi, who serve as priests, they collect a tenth or a tithe from the rest of the people, even though they and the people they collect the tithe from are both descendants of Abraham. So in one sense, they're equal with each other, even though one receives a tithe from the other. Levitical priests, they collected tithes from the people because of a provision in the law of Moses, not because of any inherent superiority that they had over the other people. They had a legal right granted to them to collect the tithe. Melchizedek, on the other hand, he says, collected a tithe from Abraham not because of any law, but because of the inherent superiority that he had over Abraham. He was not part of the family of Levi or the family of Abraham. He was a solitary figure of authority and grandeur. Abraham recognizes who Melchizedek is in that way and his obligation to pay a tithe to him. He continues here. He says that he blessed him who had the promises. It is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. So not only did Melchizedek collect a tithe from Abraham, but he blessed Abraham. The greater blesses the lesser, and Abraham received it from him, even though Abraham was the one who had the promises, it tells us, given to him by God. The author is trying to make us realize, here's Abraham, this unique individual who God selects of all of the people on the earth to give these unique promises to, that I will bless you and make you a great nation of people, and I will bless the whole world through you. Only one guy ever got that. And yet, Abraham received a blessing from, paid tithes to Melchizedek, superior to him in that way. Verse 8, he says, in the one case, tithes are received by mortal men, but in the other case, by one of whom it is testified that he lives. So the author now makes reference one more time to Melchizedek's apparent unending life, one of whom it is testified that he lives. The author is going to say down in verse 16 that Jesus has become a priest on the basis of the power of an indestructible life. That's one of my favorite descriptions of Jesus. That he has the power of an indestructible life. And so we see this parallel with Melchizedek. And this same thing. And then verse 9, he says, one might even say that Levi himself, who receives tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, for he was still in the loins of his ancestor when Melchizedek met him. The implication of Abraham paying a tithe to Melchizedek is that Levi also paid a tithe to Melchizedek, he says, because in that culture, an ancestor contained within himself all of his descendants. That's the way they saw it. So all of the blessings that Abraham received were also given to his descendants, since they are inside of him. All of the promises that Abraham received were also received by his descendants because they were inside of him at that time. And all the obligations of Abraham were also obligations of his descendants. So Melchizedek is superior to not only Abraham, but to all of his descendants, and in particular, in this case, the Levitical priests, because they too, through Abraham, paid a tithe to Melchizedek. Is your brain ready to blow up yet? Or have you fallen asleep yet? Because we're pretty much done for the day, all right? So in closing, like going, whew. I want to summarize what has been said about Melchizedek. He was a king of righteousness. He was a king of peace. He came from a different genealogy than the Levitical priests, which meant that he was a priest not because of a law regarding lineage, but because of his intrinsic character. He had an apparently unending lifespan, making him a priest forever. He collected tithes from Abraham, the father of the Jews, not because of a law allowing him to, but because of his greater authority and honor over Abraham. He blessed Abraham, the father of the Jews. Abraham received his blessing, demonstrating Abraham's submission to him. The author of Hebrews has now laid his foundation of background information for the rest of what he's going to tell us in chapter 7. You need to remember all this stuff for next week. Don't sweat it. We'll review it a little bit next week as we get into it as well. So I'll help you along. But in the remainder of chapter 7, he will explain the implications of these comparisons between Melchizedek and Jesus as it contrasts with Levitical priesthood. And then what it means to us as followers of the perfect high priest, Jesus Christ. You see, in the same way that Melchizedek was superior in every respect to the priests of the Old Covenant, which we have seen even in these few points today, Jesus Christ is truly superior to all other priests. And this is the big point that he's making, but he's presenting a whole truckload of evidence so that we get it. Because he examines this from every angle. Now, some of you may have sat through all of this today, and you're asking yourselves, well, so what? What difference does all of this have to make for me? What is the relevance of all of this? The relevance is this. Jesus Christ is the Son of God. God in human flesh, who came to rescue us from our separation from God, which is a result of our sin. What we needed was a perfect high priest, and he is exactly that. What we have here in Hebrews chapter 7 is important evidence presented to us, testifying to the identity of Jesus Christ and what he has accomplished for the human race. The scope of the priestly work of Jesus reaches beyond anything that anyone has ever been able to do, any system could ever do. He has accomplished salvation for us. And if you were here last week, you know that the word salvation is a whole lot more than fire insurance. It involves the rescue, the redemption, the reclamation, the transformation of humanity. Well, after sitting through these first 10 verses of chapter 7, maybe you have a better understanding now of why the author felt the need to pause for a moment before getting into this stuff, to confront the people of his day about their laziness, about growing in their knowledge and understanding of Jesus Christ. He knew there was some hard stuff ahead. He needed to tell them, hey, wake up. Pay attention. I want you to get this stuff. I want you to hear it and learn it. Take hold of it. And the same message is for us too. So, don't fall asleep on me. Come on, stay with us. Jesus Christ is glorious in every way imaginable. learn about him. You will grow in your appreciation of him, and you will grow to worship him more. The more you know about him, the more you understand what he has done, how he fulfills all of this stuff from the past and has accomplished things that are beyond our imagination for us. We've only scratched the surface of all that Christ has done and is going to do in us and through us and for us. In John 8:58, Jesus said about himself, "Before Abraham was, I am." And so we have seen a small glimpse of that today. Let's bow our heads. Lord, we thank you for your word. And Father, I thank you for the amazing work that you have accomplished through your Son, Jesus Christ, for us. That before the beginning of time itself, you had already determined how you would rescue us. And then as this story of humanity has played out over the centuries, you have placed within our history these various signposts and pointers and clues, illustrations of your grand plan, of what you're going to do for us and in us and through us. So we see that even in this very interesting person from ancient history, Melchizedek, as he reflects to us, your Son Jesus. Touch your people this week, Lord, with just a renewed desire to know you better, grow in our knowledge about you, Jesus. We would worship you. In your name, Jesus, we pray these things. Amen.